Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of the Lord came, by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, comma, God gave the Persian king Cyrus an urgency about this. Therefore, the release from exile was granted the very first year of his reign, and as the Lord stirred up his spirit. Now, we know from history that this was the policy of Cyrus towards the many conquered people that were within his empire, the portions that he inherited from the Babylonian Empire. So it's not as if he was doing this special favor only for the Jewish people and not for the other people whom were conquered and absorbed into the Babylonian and then into the Medo-Persian Empire. But God stirred his spirit, especially as it would apply to the Jewish people, to advance his plan of redemption, because God was dedicated to the proposition that his people would be restored, his promises would be fulfilled, they would come back into the land, that the temple would be rebuilt. All of this was important to God's prophetic plan. Now, Cyrus made a decree giving the Jewish exiles in his empire the right to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple in 538 BC. We see this from later on in chapter 1 and then in chapter 5. So, this book, though it bears the name of Ezra, who led the second return, this first return, described in the first 6 chapters, is not under Ezra. Ezra tells us about it, but it's really under a leader known as Zerubbabel. Now, it is possible that one of the things that God used to stir Cyrus, king of the Persians, to release these conquered people back to their homeland if they wanted to go, was the prophet Daniel. We have no historical evidence of this, but it's a very engaging thought to consider, is it not? That perhaps Daniel, who was a high official, even though he was quite advanced in age at that time, who was a high official in the government, first in Babylon, then when the Babylonians conquered the, when the people of the Medes and the Persians conquered the Babylonians, Daniel was then made a high official in the government of the Medes and the Persians. That's that whole time when he was cast into the lion's den and all the rest of it. During that very same time, it's possible that Daniel went to Cyrus or maybe some other high officials in his government and showed them the prophecies of Jeremiah chapter 25 verses 8 through 13 and Jeremiah chapter 29 verses 10 through 14. Isn't it possible that Daniel uses his influence to say, look, this is prophesied, this is true. As well, if he showed Cyrus such prophecies, he almost would have certainly included Isaiah chapter 44. You see, what's fascinating about this is look at verse 1 again. Cyrus, king of Persia. Here in Ezra, Cyrus, king of Persia, is mentioned as a contemporary. Ezra wrote this as Cyrus lived. But Isaiah chapter 44 mentions Cyrus by name 150 years before he lived. It's one of the most remarkable prophecies of the Bible, and it's a prophecy so remarkable and so specific that those who doubt supernatural revelation say it never happened, it was written after the fact. But again, we believe in supernatural revelation. We believe that the God who created heavens and earth at the very command of his word, that it's no problem for God to know the future and even the people of the future before they specifically exist and do their work. In Isaiah chapter 44, God specifically mentions Cyrus, the conqueror, by name. And I just imagine in my mind, Daniel, either speaking to Cyrus directly or to an official in his court, unrolling the scroll and saying, "See, Master, 150 years before Cyrus existed, God, Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, he prophesied that he would conquer and come to rule." That might be the kind of thing that would get the attention of a pagan king and draw him to listen to Daniel and to these prophecies. Now, according to Adam Clark, quote, "Josephus accounts for his partiality to the Jews from this circumstance, that he was shown the places in Isaiah the prophet where he is mentioned by name and his exploits and conquests foretold." In other words, the Jewish historian Josephus, he records that it was on the basis of these prophecies in Isaiah chapter 44 that Cyrus's heart was moved to do what Ezra chapter 1 verse 1 says that he did. So, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Now that writing is mentioned also in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 22 through 23. But it also exists in contemporary documents that have been discovered by archaeologists. Archaeologists have discovered the actual writing of these decrees that was published throughout Cyrus's Persian Empire. So what was the decree that he made? That starts at verse 2. Ready for this? "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house of Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whoever is left in the place where he dwells, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem." Now again, Cyrus shows in verse 2 a remarkable recognition of God's hand upon his life. This is an amazing testimony from a pagan king. He says, "All the kingdoms of the earth, the Yahweh God of heaven has given me." Have you noticed that? Look at that, what he says in verse 2. He says that the Lord God, he addresses God by the name Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. It seems almost impossible to us that Cyrus would do this without some kind of instruction or guidance from somebody like Daniel. And this leads us to give some truthfulness to the account of Josephus, the Jewish historian, whose writings are not the Bible, but sometimes give us some very interesting historical insight, to simply say that it's true that Daniel took the writings of Isaiah to Cyrus and showed him, leading him to make this pronouncement relevant to the God of Israel. But of course, it was also according to the general policy of the Persians. Let me read you a quote from Derek Kidner, a wonderful commentator on the Old Testament. I highly recommend his commentaries. In his commentary on the book of Ezra, he says this: "A notable feature of the Persian Empire was its integration of a great diversity of peoples into a single administrative system, while maintaining at the same time a tradition of respect for their local customs and beliefs. They were encouraged to seek the king's welfare by observing the proper forms of their own religion." So God gave this permission, and it's even recorded, this permission God gave through Cyrus, on the so-called Cyrus Cylinder, which is in custody in the British Museum to this day, which says that they were allowed to go to back to their sacred cities to entreat their local gods for the sake of the health and the prosperity of Cyrus and his kingdom. That's why he says in verse 2, look at this line in verse 2, he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem. Now, I don't think that this necessarily means that Cyrus was a believer. Maybe Cyrus felt that the more gods on his side, the better. So if I can get Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, on my side, all the good. I'll accept it, that he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem. So not only did it allow the return of the exiled people, which would be huge in itself, but it also commanded the rebuilding of the destroyed temple. And this rebuilding of the destroyed temple is going to become the central focus of these first six chapters of the book of Ezra. So he says there in verse 3, who is among you of all his people? May the Lord his God be with him and let him go up to Jerusalem. Cyrus gives not only permission, but an encouragement from the king of Persia to go forth and to carry out this job of going back to Jerusalem and rebuilding the temple. Now, the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles end with this wonderful and remarkable encouragement to return and rebuild Jerusalem. And this was the necessary and the helpful encouragement to the very first readers of Chronicles, telling them that their connection with God's plan of the ages was still there. He's not done with you. Come back to the land, rebuild the temple. Now, it was very sad that a small percentage only decided to make this return from exile. But the small percentage that did needed a lot of encouragement to do what would be a very difficult work, yet it would make a very valuable contribution to God's unfolding plan. But again, we're not surprised by the fact that God would work in and through a remnant. He often works through a small percentage of the whole. In Isaiah chapter 10, verse 22, God promised that only a remnant would return from the exile, but God would work through that remnant. And then he adds in verse 4, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, not only would they build a temple as sort of like a community center, but it was going to be a place of sacrifice. The freewill offerings mean that the altar would be rebuilt and it would be a functioning temple complete with sacrifice. The rebuilding of the temple becomes the central theme of the book of Ezra, especially these first four chapters. Beginning with the decree of Cyrus, the intention is not merely to return and repopulate the land, which would be glorious in and of itself, but to rebuild the temple. Now, I make an interesting connection to the modern day, don't we? Israel has returned in a wonderful, even a glorious way, since the modern Zionist movement, and especially since the reestablishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Yet they did not come with the same heart as Ezra and these particular returning remnant did. This returning remnant in the day of Ezra basically said, what's the use of coming back if we don't come back with the temple? Now, of course, it's a very different historical situation, but it's an interesting connection that their goal in coming back was not just patriotic, was not just to have their own piece of land to farm, but no, their goal in coming back was very deliberately spiritual, to come and rebuild the temple. Okay, verses 5 and 6. Now we come into the section speaking of the response of the people to this invitation. In the first four verses, Cyrus has invited. Okay, everybody, go back. He's encouraged them to go back. Now what are they going to do with it? Now let's start at verse 5. Then the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, with all whose spirits God had moved, arose to go up and build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all those who were around them encouraged them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with precious things, besides all that was willingly offered. So what do we have here? Well, next we have that the spirit of those whom God had moved gave generously to the work. The returning exiles were a minority, but they were a spirit-stirred minority. They were very dedicated to the difficult and discouraging task of returning to a ruined city and once there to build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. It was a tough job. It was a tough job for many reasons. They faced many difficulties, and it was a good thing that God had moved their spirits. First of all, the journey was long, it was dangerous, it was expensive. Secondly, they returned to a city that was in ruins, had no proper homes, roads, city institutions. Third, they didn't have all the material resources that they needed. They came to a land where you couldn't just go down to the local home improvement store and buy everything that you needed. They lacked the material resources, or at least all the material resources that they need. Next, they didn't all return to Jerusalem, but they spread out over the province of Judah. If all 50,000 came and just returned to Jerusalem, it would have been different. In some ways, it would have been easier, but they spread out over the province. It was also difficult because they had many enemies who opposed them in the work. And then actually, the land was not their own. It was in possession of another empire. Listen, the fact that these people had their hearts stirred to go and do a difficult work, it should stir us. You know, I've spent some years of my life living in or visiting Europe to do ministry. And I can't help but make the connection to returning exiles to go back and rebuild a work from the connection of what we have here in America going back to Europe. I mean, look, this is what we know, that in the grand historical sweep of things, Christianity came from Europe to America. I mean, this is how it worked in the span of history. But now, by many measures, the cause of Jesus Christ, the vitality of the kingdom of God, is much stronger in America than it is in Europe. Spiritually speaking, kingdom of God speaking, you go back to Europe and sometimes it looks like desolation. It looks like ruins. And it's a difficult work. You talk to people who have been Christian workers, missionaries, pastors, church planters, workers over there in Europe, and oftentimes they'll tell you of just how lonely and isolated and difficult it can feel. You feel like, man, you come back to America, or at least some parts of America, and there's a vibrant, sizable Christian community around you to support you, to give you encouragement. You go over there and you don't have it. Now, I think it's a wonderful thing when God's people take the attitude, we're going to embrace the difficult jobs. That was always an emphasis of ours when we spoke to students at our Bible college in Germany. We tried to impress upon them this attitude. Hey, let's be the people who go out and do the difficult jobs. You're always going to have people who are willing to do the easier jobs. Why don't we be the ones who go out to the hard places, who want to help the struggling work instead of come along the church that's already flourishing? Why don't we be the ones who want to go plant the church in the place that's hard instead of the place where it's easy? Now, I'm not trying to say, and I hope nobody understands me wrongly, God will call people to go and help works in flourishing places. God needs his people sometimes and calls them to places where the work is strong and needs to be maintained in a strong way and expand even further. But I hope you sense some of the heart that I'm speaking about. I hope you sense some of that passion that just says, Lord, send me to a hard place. Let me do a difficult work for you. I'm sure that I could serve and honor you if I stayed right here in the Persian kingdom. But you've opened up a door and I have the opportunity to do something that's going to be hard, to do something that's going to bring some trial and tribulation in my life. But there's a lot of people who won't do it. Let me be among those who will. I got to say, there's something stirring about these people who did this. And so they were called, verse 5, those who arose to go up and build the house of the Lord. A good number of the descendants of those who were exiled, some two generations before, they decided to return to their ancestral land. These went. Now look, make no mistake about it. Many more stayed behind in the land of their exile. They had become quite comfortable there. And I don't say it to condemn those people. Maybe they had good reason to stay behind. But when you just look at the numbers, aren't we just a little bit shocked? We go, oh man, I wish it was more who went. I mean, it was good that these went, but I wish it was more. But if many were to stay behind, at least this was good. Look at verse 6. And all those who were around them encouraged them. And this encouragement was more than verbal. It was tangible encouragement of financial and practical backing for the work. I can just imagine them saying, look, you, Zerubbabel, you're going to go. I'm not going to go. I feel a little bit guilty about not going. Whatever the circumstance of my life, whatever I believe the calling of my God is, I don't believe that I'm supposed to go. But listen, I'll tell you this. I'm going to support you in your going. I'm going to give you financial and practical resources. I would almost say this, and I'm not going to pass this as some kind of law to weigh you down. I mean, we live under the dispensation of Jesus' gospel. I mean, after all, we believe that the law came by Moses and grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. We believe that with all of our heart. But let's not mistake this. Maybe it's a good just idea for us to think about, to say this. You know what? If I myself will not go to a difficult place and serve God, then with God's help, I'm going to really come alongside somebody who has gone to a difficult place. And I'm going to pray for them. I'm going to support them. I'm going to send them whatever assistance I can, both spiritually and practically. I think that's a wonderful mentality to have. So this is what they wanted to do. We can imagine that many of those who decided to stay in the land of their exile, they were happy that other people were going. They were happy, as verse 5 says, to go and build the house of the Lord, and they wanted to support that work. There's one commentary, Edwin Yamauchi, who mentions a cave inscription from this period. It was found in a place of southern Israel, and it reads this: I am Yahweh, thy God. I will accept the cities of Judah and will redeem Jerusalem. It's been suggested that this cave inscription expresses the heart and the mind of a returning exile. It expresses his trust in God's faithfulness to restore despite the desolation of Jerusalem. Isn't that an awesome thing? To think of one of these returning exiles before he can build himself a home, sheltering he and his family in a nearby cave. Oh, sure, he's going to farm the land. He's going to build a home. He's going to do all those proper things. But just for a few nights, they're going to shelter themselves in a cave. And in the darkness of that night, he inscribes upon a wall these words: I am Yahweh, thy God. I will accept the cities of Judah and will redeem Jerusalem. He says, that's the promise of God to us. We're going to go forth boldly with that sort of attitude. So they did. They went forth. And verses 7 through 11 describe their return and the return of the articles of the house of the Lord. Ready? King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem and put in the temple of his gods. And Cyrus, king of Persia, brought them out by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. This is the number of them: 30 gold platters, 1,000 silver platters, 29 knives, 30 gold basins, 410 silver basins of a similar kind, and 1,000 other articles. All the articles of gold and silver were 5,400, all these Sheshbazzar took with the captives who were brought from Babylon to Jerusalem. I love this about King Cyrus. King Cyrus didn't only give permission for the exiles to return and rebuild, but he also gave encouragement. We saw that in the first few verses. He actively encouraged them, go back and build your temple. Go back and build the house of your God. But further than just giving permission, further than just giving encouragement, he also actually gave them the things that had been plundered from the temple 50 years before when the Babylonians destroyed the temple. Now, I said 50 years before, but actually it might have even been sooner than that. Did I tell you before that there were actually three phases of the conquest of Jerusalem? The first one, the second one, the third one. Well, in, of course, the third one, that's when Jerusalem was completely destroyed. The temple was completely despoiled of everything that it had. But even in the first two attacks, the Babylonians plundered some of the temple and took away some of the silver and the gold articles, some of the treasures of the temple. Part of it was just because, look, these were looters. These were, you know, rapacious conquerors who wanted to take whatever they could. But there was another meaning of it as well. When you conquer your enemy's gods, their temple, and take their stuff from your temple and put it in yours, isn't that a very strong proclamation, a way of saying our God is mightier than yours? The gods of Babylon are mightier than Yahweh, the God of Israel. After all, look, we have a bunch of gods in Babylon. You guys only have one over Israel. We must be greater. We must be mightier. Now, no doubt his heart touched by God, Cyrus, the king of the Persians, turns to these returning exiles, and he says, look at that in verse 7, King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the house of the Lord. When Jerusalem was conquered, the remaining treasures of the temple were taken to Babylon. That's in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 18. Now, they had a very generous policy under the Persians, not under the Babylonians who took them, saying, take them back, take them back. And they put them in the custody of, look at it here in verse 8, Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. This man was an important leader of the first part of the resettlement of Judah. Remember those two names, Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar. We're not naming kids these names anymore, are we? I haven't heard that at the baby naming party or anything like that, but these were two significant men. Some people believe that this was a partner to Zerubbabel. There are a few people who believe that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel were the same guy, just different names. I tend towards the belief that there's two different men, one named Sheshbazzar, one named Zerubbabel. Although there is some debate on that point. But notice, they gave a very careful reckoning. Verse 9 gives the inventory of what they're going to take back. It's very careful. This is the number of them. 30 gold platters, 1,000 silver platters, 29 knives, and etc. They were carefully treated and inventoried to take back to the temple. Now, as you take a look at that list, does anything strike you? You got the gold platters. You got the silver platters. You got the knives. You got this. What don't you have? You don't have the Ark of the Covenant. You don't have some of the other vessels that are so specifically mentioned being first part of the tabernacle of Israel and then the temple of Israel. There is no mention of the altar of incense, of the table of showbread, of the brazen altar, of the golden lampstand, and especially there is no mention of the Ark of the Covenant. These articles were presumably lost to history at the destruction of the temple by the Babylonians. We have no mention of them after that. There are Jewish traditions. Did I say history? No, I said traditions. Did I say it's in the Bible? No, I said these are Jewish traditions. That Jeremiah the prophet hid the Ark of the Covenant before the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. They say that they hid the Ark of the Covenant in one of the many caverns that's under the Temple Mount. It's a fascinating thing that the geology of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem means that it's filled with caves and caverns underneath. It is possible, I didn't say it was a strong possibility, it might be a remote possibility, but it's possible that the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant exists to this day in a cavern underneath the Temple Mount. Now, I have a couple interesting thoughts about that. First of all, one time I was preaching on this at my church in Santa Barbara, and there was a mention of this, and I had a very sweet Ethiopian lady come up to me afterwards and say, "Pastor David, we know exactly where the Ark of the Covenant is. The Coptic Church says that it's on an island in the middle of a river in Ethiopia, and that's where the Ark of the Covenant, they just don't want anybody to see it, but it's right there." And so the Coptic believers of Ethiopia have a very strong belief that they have the Ark of the Covenant. It's a little bit dubious by the fact that nobody has ever seen it. The second thought there is, if it's possible, and I'll admit that it's a remote possibility, it's a remote possibility, but it is possible that the Ark of the Covenant exists, that it is in a cavern under the Temple Mount. And did I clarify that? That's a remote possibility. But what I find fascinating too is that if for some reason it would be discovered, would that not be the most amazing impulse to the Jewish people saying, we have to rebuild a temple? If they discovered the Ark, I think that there would be an overwhelming push among the Jewish people, most of whom don't care anything about rebuilding a temple. Nothing. But if for some reason they were to discover the Ark, I think that would give a huge push. And so I'll allow the remote possibility that the Ark still exists, that because it's covered in gold, which is a metal that does not decay, according to how pure it is at least, that it could still be in some kind of stable condition. And if it were to be discovered in this day or in these last days, it could be the impetus, one of several things that would push forward the idea that the temple must be built again, which I believe many Christians would disagree on my understanding of prophecy of this, but I'm not alone on this, many would agree with this, but that in the very last days there will be a temple rebuilt and on the Temple Mount. And if the Ark were to be discovered, then that could be it. But we do know this. We do know that the Ark was not part of the second temple. The temple that existed in Jesus' day had no Ark of the Covenant. Matter of fact, to my understanding, and I'm doing this from memory, so I might be in error, but to my understanding, the high priest on the Day of Atonement in Jesus' day did not even go into the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies was empty, and all that they did on the Day of Atonement was sprinkle the sacrificial blood upon the veil of the Holy of Holies. So, but it's definitely true, there was no Ark of the Covenant existing in the second temple that would be rebuilt in Ezra's day. All right, so this is what we come to at the end of Ezra chapter 1. Cyrus gave permission, he gave encouragement, and he gave the articles that were plundered from the previous temple. He sent them back with his authority to make the trip back. When we come back to this next time, we're going to come to Ezra chapter 2, and we're going to work through this list of those who came back and then see what they did when they came back.